My name's Elijah, and welcome to the Roots Hospitality Podcast.
Yes, chef! Yes. One. Yes. Yes.
Welcome to episode 53 with Aaron Tease.
Basically, to circle around to it, I think writing a book that kind of encapsulates all that will be really cool. Yeah. I think it'll be really, really cool. Like, will there be a section for like a chef like me that'll be, if you're heroing some of the plants, for example,
yeah,
that will be plant-based or vegan, so it can, or is it going to be very kind of game dense?
Look, I think with anything, it'll be a mixture of everything.
Yeah.
It has to be these days. You can't have something that is literally just based on proteins and
or fish
or anything else that comes with it, seafood as a whole. You've got to have that aspect. I think the hardest part is, that you would know being a forager, is trying to find a full foraged based dish as a whole. You can use your yams, you can grab this, you can grab that, but majority of the time you're collecting leaves, you've got your lily pillies, or you've got things that are not designed to be as a whole dish. It's a finishing substitute, or it's
an alternative.
Or it can be turned into a puree, but you don't want to serve five different purees on a plate and be like, ta-da, look what I've made. It doesn't work like that. So I think it's a lot easier to have that seafood side of things, or that part. And then, you know, I think most of the time these days, I don't read a cookbook to ever see the product as a whole. You never want to replicate what somebody else has done.
Right.
But you can look at it and be like, that was a great idea.
Yeah.
I really like that. Or this could be used as a puree instead. Or I like this aspect of it. Or that's a different method of doing something, but I would put it personally onto a different protein or a different meat or a different vegetable. Yeah, so you can have your roasted cabbage, but then you can have purees or grains or puffs or whatever else that you find from here, there and everywhere incorporated onto a different dish. But you've just taken ideas from different chefs from all over the world, different styles of cooking, different, you know, nationalities and all that sort of stuff, and pair it back into something that you've created as your own. It's you know, it's so hard to come up with authentic, natural things these days without having to take or look at what other people are doing. And, you know, there's so many really talented chefs out there that are pushing the boundaries.
Mm.
Yet at the same time, it's not an idea that's just popped into somebody's head. They've been starting with fermentation one way or another. And usually what I find, it comes from mistakes. That you're like, oh, that wasn't good. I'm like, oh, actually, that's got really good flavor. Oh, I like that. Or you forget to put something in it and something changes to something else, or you didn't have the ingredient to make something on the day. So you substitute it with something else. And we're lucky here, like, we've got so many wild weeds and bits and pieces traveling around the property of 10 acres. Every now and again, it's like, oh, I haven't got this garnish for this. Oh, it's all right. I'll just go and grab something. And you put it on a plate and you're like, oh, that's actually really good. That ties in well. I wouldn't have thought about that. But then again, you're working with seasons. So the seasonality ties back into what you're preparing and how it's all coming together. So it's an interesting way of doing it.
Yeah, walking around here is so sick. Like, there's just so much potential as well. Like, I don't know how long your game plan is to be here, but like when I walk on here, and it's just like, you have so much space to do, have a setup like Bray, or like, you know, these restaurants that have their own garden off to the side, where it's like you have chefs that can go and farm one day a week and just kind of like rotate and look after it. Like, that's, I mean, I don't know if that's something that you think about, but like, it's just those kind of ideas are awesome, just because I can make it endless.
And there's something I've definitely planned and spoken about. Like, we've got the bees, we've got a whole heap of natives growing in here. The hardest part is we're events. So every single time we look at it, it comes down to writing a seasonal menu. Four times a year, they get to pick and choose what they want 6 weeks out. And you don't really have the change and adaptability that you would in a restaurant, going, hey, we've got this on stock, ready to go now.
Right.
Let's put on a special for this. Otherwise, you know, it just ruins that aspect of it. But with like Rabar Farm that we're just taking on and building up as a co-op and a community garden in Madrabar, that is where we want to learn, grow, run workshops on growing herbs and all that sort of stuff. And we've already started to tee up with local suppliers to say, hey, this is what we're doing. It's going to be, you know, hyper local to all of these businesses. Is this something you're interested in? Every one of our fruit and veg suppliers has said, absolutely. Like,
yeah, sick.
We will, you, this is what we're roughly going through in amounts. If you can grow this, we'd much rather buy through somewhere local. And
oh, wow.
You know, if you, as a business side of things, as the co-op, can't support that,
yeah,
then we
yeah.
can also, we can bulk it up with all of our other bits and pieces. But for people to be able to know that yeah. it's coming from less than 10 kilometers away and it's on the menu,
that's sick.
They're really interested in that side of things. So we're starting to, you know, build garden beds and grow leafy greens.
Yeah, really. Yeah,
you've got your rockets, you've got parsley, lettuces, all that sort of stuff that we know you can grow in 6 to 8 weeks.
Wow.
From seed right through. So yeah, that side of things is a fun alternative where we can then start to make money as a co-op as well, which means that we can put more money into the education process and
yeah,
having
yeah, yeah.
a farmer or somebody interested full-time on the property to be able to manage that. Where at the
That's
moment
sick.
It's like 5 or 6 of us or 10 of us now that go in as often as we can during the week when everyone's got busy lives, everyone's
yeah,
doing everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, it's much easier now with winter, the grass is a little bit lower,
wow.
Everything grows a little bit slower.
Yeah.
But come summer, like 10 acres and having to mow twice a week is a bit of a punish, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah.
It
yeah.
really is. And, you know, it's a love-hate relationship. And then
yeah.
we had all the floods, and so the farm itself is somewhat flooded 3 times this year.
Really?
And so
like
you sit
here,
there.
I just mean here.
Oh, yeah, right, not right through here, but right up to the back of the
yeah,
lake.
Yeah, yeah,
is even Far. The chicken coop was nearly 5 foot under.
Shit.
So, yeah, very...
That's wild.
The owner's husband went out and rescued the chickens on a
yeah.
paddleboard. I was like, there's no way those chickens are going to get on a paddleboard.
Fucking hell.
Every single one of them jumped on that paddleboard.
Really?
Yeah, it was paddling back with 10 chickens like, to the main road.
That's so
So far that he pretty much got over the fence line.
Wow.
So if you're thinking about the height
yeah.
variance of things. Yeah, so
That's
yeah,
insane.
Chickens know how to paddleboard when they're in distress.
Fucking hell. Yeah, it's so incredible. Yeah. Like, it's so nice, especially as a chef, to have that freedom and flexibility, because I think when you work in restaurants, all you think about, especially when you do a lot of foraging, you're so thinking about things to be hyper seasonal and to go and pick things yourself. It's such a labor of love. So like, to be in a space where you can just go pick your lemons or your citruses, and it's like
yeah.
it's like a meditation in yourself.
It is,
you know, like it's so sick.
And then
so sick.
I think the best part is, doesn't matter who you're doing it around, people are always interested.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter whether we've got people walking through the property or it's the staff, front of house, back of house staff. They're like, oh, can you show me how to do that? Or we've got
yeah,
beehives
yeah.
and everyone's like, so what do you do? How do you do this? And it's like, oh, I'll put a bee suit on and we'll go through and we'll check it next week. And they come in out of their own time
yeah, yeah.
to get an understanding of why we're doing what we're doing, how
That's
the
cool.
bees work and operate and that sort of process, which
That's sick.
Is interesting. Like, we've had them closed up for the last probably 6-7 weeks because it's just so cold. And everyone's like, oh, so when do we get to play with the bees again? And it's just like, oh, you're interested in that? Like, you did that one? You really want to know about this?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So now we're talking about splitting hives and getting more and
wow.
and doing that sort of process with staff that,
yeah.
you know, I think everyone's interested in that sort of stuff, but most people don't have the opportunity to just tag along.
Yeah, yeah.
Same with foraging. You talk to anyone about foraging, they're like, oh, that's amazing, that's great. But then the opportunities aren't there or... You know, when you're doing workshops, it's
yeah.
usually for me, I'm like trying to, you do it so quickly. It's not like you go out and forage.
Mm.
You find stuff and you pick it when it's available and you see it. Like, you can be driving along the highway and be like, oh, look at the size
yeah,
of that. That's amazing. Pull over, grab this, grab that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we found in Currumbin not long ago, a whole tree of white aspen.
Really?
And it was around for ages. We've got probably 4 or 5 kilos in the freezer.
Wow.
And I kept going back to, you know, take everything in moderation.
Yeah. yeah
Other
yeah.
people know about it. Drop a pin on it.
Yeah.
But like, everything's pinpointed, and I put dates and times that I was there and what the rough conditions were
yeah,
a month
yeah.
prior, a month after, because it changes.
Yeah.
Every
yeah,
single
yeah,
year.
Yeah.
I can't even keep up anymore.
Yeah.
What I think would be growing now, I go out and there's nothing.
Mm.
But yeah, so it's having use of those sorts of bits and pieces, but you just grab it because it was there and you knew what it was. I was walking the dog in the dog park, and so I was like, well, I'll grab that. And then it's like, oh, I'm going to go and do this. But you do it in your own time
yeah, yeah, yeah.
a lot of the time, and it's not something, you know, you run tours and that sort of thing, but it's hard because as soon as you start running a tour or people are paying for it, you're under the pressure of actually really having to find
yeah.
an abundance of things which not naturally grow next to each other. Mm. It, one runs into another, but trying to gain that experience. I think the Bondi to Bronte walk is probably one of the best examples of being able to find different things available in a short space of time. And I used to use that all the time because you'd have your sea lettuces and, yeah. and kelps and, you know, there'd be wild nasturtiums and what else is there? Watercress, warrigal yeah. greens, runs Turkish right through. Yeah, the whole lot. Yeah. Amaranth. Everything was there. And it was just that little kilometre.
It's so sick.
It's just so available. I actually really miss that up here on the Gold Coast. It's everything I've found so far. And I suppose it's because you drive between things. You don't actually walk along the tracks. Yeah. I've actually considered, and I hate saying this, no offence to anyone, but like thinking about taking up cycling because it was one of those things where I'm like, you would just see so much more. And you know, a mate of mine, Gavin, he travels, you know, 60, 70, 80 kilometers. You know, Wolfie does 100 kilometers at a time just for fun.
Yeah.
And I'm like, but you'd see it slower and understand it. We've got all Currumbin Hills and Talabudra Valley and all that sort of stuff where like that's a lot of the stuff that grows on the side of the road, you'd actually take in a lot more.
Yeah.
When you're going, I suppose they don't go much slower actually than a car these days, but you're in and amongst it. Like you smell lemon myrtle before you find it more often than not and that sort of thing. So it's working with that side of things to make it a little bit more fun.
Yeah. Oh, it's good, man. And it's nice to see the more volume of like ingredients and recipes and just kind of like a more of a perspective on it as well. Like it's nice to see books that are using it because like you also get to learn, like, cause you're especially someone who knows how to pick it, how you know how to work with it is just from like experience and just trial and error. And it's like so nice to have other people, like to follow people, whether it be like Ben Devlin or something like that, use these ingredients in different ways and you're like, oh, that's so clever, I didn't see it, like, you know, me for you
or
so many chefs along the coast that are like really like using these ingredients, and it's so cool because so many people are putting their heads together and using their own experience with ingredients and applying the techniques they know to these ingredients. And it's like really, really opening the game of like bringing them back, you know? And that's really, especially for a fine dining restaurant as well.
Yeah.
You know, like you can't just make dandelion coffee all the time or dandelion tea. Like you got to get creative or, you know, like you can't just use kelp for a dashi all the time. Like you get creative, you make sorbets or whatever it is. Like,
but then again, you've also got to look at the amount that you're collecting and how long that lasts. Like I remember years ago, it would have been 15 years when we first started it with Studio Neon in the back warehouse of Redfern. My chef and I were like, oh, let's go and collect fennel seeds one year, and went down south and collected the whole van, I think, was full just of fennel tips.
Yeah.
And like, this is going to be amazing. Like, you know, we're going to have so many fennel seeds. We went through 6-week drying process and it took us literally probably 5 or 6 hours to filter through it all and get the fennel seeds left over. Wow. We ended up with about 125 grams of fennel seeds. And that was it.
Fuck.
Out of a whole,
reminds
whole
me of water van seed. Full.
And we're like, oh no, what have we done? Like, what a waste of time. But then we started using the seeds, and the first dish we made with it was sort of like a pork belly or whatever it was.
Yeah.
Maybe a porchetta. And you throw in half a handful of seeds that you usually would. It was so overpowered, we literally threw it out. And we worked out that everything that we'd used like 20 seeds to, you were going back to like 1 to 4 seeds.
Fuck.
And that was it. Like you could put 2 seeds into a broth and it would completely overpower it. So it was the difference of wild, native, or, you know, not necessarily native, but that wild plant that's based in the area, it's then grown from strength to strength through all the seasons. The quality of that so far outweighs any of the herbs and spices that you're getting from anywhere else.
So so potent.
Even if you compare, you know, lemon myrtle that you collect off the property and dehydrate yourself and then blend up, as opposed to any product, product powder you can buy out there.
Yeah.
It's chalk and cheese. Like you can never go back.
Yeah.
We had suppliers come out with native products the other day. Like, oh, I'll try this. And I'm like, sorry, I can get nearly all of this within 5 kilometers from here. So as much as I love the product, I love the company that they're doing, I hope they're giving back to the mobs and the indigenous elders as needed. But like, I'm lucky I've got this at my disposal. I can't go back to a powdered version all that process in between.
Yeah.
It's changed, and it's good that we can get those sorts of plants readily available now that we can start to grow it as well. So
yeah,
it's changing.
Yeah, where do you think that started for you?
I think for myself, it was one of those things that I'd just finished up at working at Est and took on the studio space, which we ended up calling Studio Neon, and starting doing pop-up events and things like that, where you went out of restaurants doing 70 hours a week plus, being told what you could and couldn't do, working with budgets, all these sorts of things that you had to be so strict on, and serving people at the time to a two-hat, nearly three-hat level. Mm. It took me getting out of the kitchen and then starting to really want to know where our produce was coming from. We got told where throughout all the restaurants where the produce came from, a little bit about the farm, but we never had the time to go out and visit the farms or see these people or understand that process. I think it's changed a lot over the time where people are actually going out and collecting this thing firsthand, like collecting the product firsthand off the farmers, or wanted to understand a lot more about where it's coming from.
Yeah.
And for me, it was getting out and actually going to the farms, experiencing these things, talking to these people and understanding that process of farming. And then you could start to tie one thing into another. And you're like, oh, well, you know, if you've got this beautiful duck breast and you've got straw and this, and that all ties in. So you're hay smoking duck breasts and that sort of stuff, which is based around the farm concept. Or then you'd look down in the fields and they've got, you know, blackberries growing and all that sort of stuff as well. So part of it would then all tie through, and then you've ended up getting a dish from it. And then the more time you spend out on the farms, you started to realize that these farmers have got mass weed problems like purslane nettle and all this other stuff that you start to work and look a bit broader. And being able to take that back to Studio Neon, where we didn't have any boundaries.
Mm.
We usually only did one or two events a week, so we had more time on our hands to start to play and understand things and research stuff. And if it didn't work the first time, you just go and collect some more because it didn't cost you anything.
Yeah.
Even though when you're starting up a small business, you're so worried about the costs involved and how it all works.
Yeah.
It was one of those things that if you could get it readily available for free, you could play around with as many different things. And if it didn't work, you just go and get some more.
That's sick.
Yeah. And it was so much fun to be able to look at things from an outsider's perspective and try something new and then just work and work and work and work and work until you got something you were happy with.
Yeah. Absolutely. But I will say to add on to your point about, for example, being at Est, you know, only knowing very minimal information about the produce and the farms and stuff like that. Like, big props, for example, like I just went recently on a tour by Sydney Direct Fresh Produce. And Luke Kohler takes these, like I think it's like once or twice, I think it's like once a week or once every 2 weeks, he'll host a different one. He just had a truffle one down in Canberra.
And
it gets like a bus full of like 30 chefs who want to come to these farms and go there and experience it and pick and understand. And like, he just does that, like just purely for free, just as a way to give back to the chefs.
Yeah.
It's very, very industry. And I love it. Like, we just went to one like a month or two ago and we went to Persimmon Farm, which was crazy.
Yeah, great. We've got a persimmon tree just over here.
Bullshit.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
The bats get them faster than we get them every single time.
Yeah. And I had no clue what to expect for a persimmon tree. I had no clue. I thought it was like any other regular tree. It'd just be like full of leaves and this thing that you get there and it's like an empty twig tree with just fruits that come off. And I was like, what the fuck? That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's sick. And then, you're able to pick it and taste it while the farmer tells you about it and tells you cool stories and, you know, the history of persimmons and stuff. And then we went to another one by the Grimers brothers who had, like, this whole veg farm, and it was just, like, crazy just talking about, like, the economics of farming and the world scale of, like, how a little small farm can be affected by what's going on. And we went to a microgreens farm by Windy Hills. And Just in one day, and it was so good. Like, having a place for these tours where chefs can go and learn about this is so sick.
Yeah.
That's so important. It really changes how you value the food on your plate too.
Agreed.
Like, you get to look at it. I suppose it'd be the same when you pick it yourself, that you actually give a fuck about it.
Yeah.
Not that you shouldn't give a fuck about it anyway, but like, you give an extra fuck when you pick the stuff, or you know the people that are picking the growing the stuff, and you're like...
For me, I think that's where farmers markets are so important, for everyone to get to a farmers market to really support the guys there.
Yeah.
Because I found that when you don't, you can have product in your fridge, you finish your week and then you go shopping and you pretty much empty your fridge.
Yeah.
Give half the stuff to the chickens, the dog, anything else that we can use, and the rest goes in the bin.
Yeah.
Once you start buying from people that you see every single week and you have to go back and see them again, like even though you've bought the product, the love you put into that, nothing gets thrown out.
Yeah.
It's this full circle where you're like, oh, well, if we've done this, we have to do this, and then we have to do this and go through that process, and we'll use every last scrap of it.
Yeah.
Until we get to this point and we're happy to go back to them again next week and be like, oh, that was delicious. This was really, really good. This is what I made with it. They're always asking questions. If you weren't happy with something, you also go back to them and you tell them like, yeah, no worries. Like, I'll take that on board, this, and this. Yeah, that was probably picked a little bit green. We'll leave it longer next time. And you know, to build those relationships with people, they'll also come to us now at the market and say, oh, don't buy that, Aaron. It's not going to be up to your standards.
Oh,
and
I'm really?
Like, what do you mean? It's like, oh, you won't be happy with that because we've done this, and this. But they'll be completely honest and tell you where they're at and why, because they know how I'm going to use it.
Yeah.
Where, I could probably poach it and it'd be fine. But because I was going to use it fresh or as this or that, then, you know, you've got to look at different aspects or that teach tell you why they're saying that it's not going to be there. And I think it's a huge importance. And, you know, it's getting out there and experiencing these things before you really start to understand a lot about where your food comes from, why it's doing what it is, and how we go about understanding that better, which I think is the great way of doing things.
Yeah. Were you, when you were at Est, was that under Peter Doyle?
Yes. Yeah.
How was that?
It was good. Yeah, it was hard. I think both Josh Nyland and Wolfie, they were the junior sous chefs at the time.
Was Tristan Rosie there too?
Yeah, Tristan was there.
That's a fucking all-star cast.
Where was it? Who else was there? Oh, I can't even think. Bloody hell, that was going back a while now.
10 years.
But yeah, we were all there. It was fun. It was a challenge. It was definitely a challenge.
What do you mean by that?
Oh, look, it's the same as any restaurant these days. Like, it's the fine dining. It was fine dining, two hats. Peter Doyle had huge expectations, and the quality of food was there. The service, still probably some of the best service I've seen in a restaurant, from wait staff and things like that. Everyone taking a single meal out and putting it down. but yeah, the numbers that we put through that kitchen were pretty substantial at the time, and it was a lot of fun. I suppose you're still young chefs back at that stage, and just pushing and striving for bigger and better things. And yeah, it's very good groundwork to be able to understand what quality of food you could put up with that standard or high-end standard, with the pressures on everyone being that equipment, kitchen size, all that sort of stuff as well. It was a thoroughly enjoyable time. It was fun.
Yeah. Now that you know where like Wolfie and Tristan and Josh are now, like, do you ever look back and go, oh, it's crazy, I remember you 10 years ago and you did this, and it's so crazy to see where you are now? Like, you know those moments where you look like, oh, I knew you when you were like, you know, 10 years younger, and you're such a, you know, your experience is far less. So it's like, it's so cool just because you were able to work with them in the trenches, you know? So like, you've got those stories.
Yeah. Look, it's so true. And it's like anything you do with everybody. You always become close knit family while you're there in that time, in that moment. You change restaurants, you change businesses, you change this, and you kind of hold on to people like, oh yeah, we know each other and that sort of stuff. But then, as time goes on, it filters off. But you look at what the guys are doing now. Like Josh Nyland, he's killing it. I don't know what goes through his head, how he comes up with the stuff he does. It's out of control. And hats off to him. Like, he's educated so many people in the way of fish, and not just chefs, but also the way that he's made it public and accessible for everybody out there is what I really appreciate. Because I think as a chef, what we are now trying to do is educate public in not only the way that we're cooking and why we're cooking it, but then now we're trying to educate them in the process of costings and things, because everything you write up, people are like, oh yeah, we make this at home for this cost. Why do we have to pay extra in a restaurant? All the added costs that come in on top of it as well. And that's the hard part, is you're trying to work with these products and to a high level, but everyone thinks they can do it now. And that's a killer. And to see people like, you know, Josh that comes through with fish. And I suppose it was like many chefs prior to that using cheap cuts of meat with your You know, we used to get given beef cheeks as a first and second year apprentice to put in stocks and sauces and things like that for free.
Yeah.
I think they're nearly as expensive as Scotch fillet now.
It's crazy. Yeah.
And, you know, chicken liver, I think we paid $13 a kilo the other day for it. I was like, where did that come from? Oh, they're in high demand at the moment. It's like $13 for liver.
Yeah, it's crazy.
We used to get given it. So it's those times and changes. So, but yeah, like every single one of them is doing such a good job out on their own now as well. And it's good to see how people have come through, been mentored by certain people, and you work with different people as well, like throughout the same, you know, you can see these people, how they've been mentored and the way that they do things or mannerisms in kitchens and that sort of stuff. It showcases through based on who their chefs were at times and that process as well. Like, you know, certain things I still do, I still, you know, much to everyone's disgust, is have a tea towel over my shoulder. But I was working with Jeremy Strode and it was drilled into you couldn't have it on your waist or around your waist, because every time you ducked down it'd hit the floor, and that's, you know, so keep it on your shoulder. And, you know, even that stuck throughout to the point where I do it now. And I look at people that have it on the tucked around their apron, like, oh yeah, but oh, I bet you that lands on the floor. Just in your mindset of your head. But yeah, no, it's good to see. It's really good to see how they've done and come through, and each respectfully is doing their own thing as well, which is fantastic.
Yeah, because I remember Tristan, I don't know whether you maybe listened to the podcast, but he was telling me about what it was like working with Peter Doyle, and one of the stories he shared of how, like, you know, higher the standard was there working for him was like, he once bought he was like prepping or whatever, I don't know what he was cutting, but Peter Doyle came up to him and was like, you know, like, you know, what are you chopping with a spoon here, chef, or some shit, you know? And it's like, oh fuck. And in the break he went to the closest knife shop, which would have been like, not, I don't know what was around 10 years ago, but he just bought this like brand new knife, like brand new Japanese knife, just like loaded like cash, whatever cash he had, like get this brand new knife. And he came back and he was like using this knife to chop something, and then like Peter Doyle came over and saw what he was chopping and like just noticed he had a new knife and like kind of just like took over, and he's like, this knife's fucking blunt, mate. Fucking blunt. Tristan's like, it's a brand new knife, shit.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's fucking blunt. It's blood. And it's like, what? And it was just like, what the fuck? Like you just buy a brand new knife and it's still not good enough.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, do you have any stories like that of working at Est?
Oh, look, you know, there's probably so many. Most of them have just sort of blanked out. There was one crab dish we used to do, and it was like it was when pressure fruit first started coming out. The juice, and it was super crystal clear apple juice.
Wow.
And it was pressurized to make it clear. We were doing a nice jelly with it, and it was just one of those things that didn't matter how well you followed the recipe, how many times you followed the recipe, it was never good enough. And you'd look at it, and I swear it was exactly the same every single time. Like, you sometimes wanted to put it in the fridge and pull it out the next day and be like, oh, here it is, and see if it was okay that day. But it was one of those things you struggle with, and it had to be the right consistency and texture to then cut it out with cookie cutters and then put it on top of things. But
wow,
it'd be frozen to then lift it off and put it onto the crab dish along with some apple and other bits and pieces. Yeah. And, you know, it was one of those things, if it sat on the pass for any more than 30 seconds, it was ruined. But most times it had to sit there for more than 30 seconds for it to be ready to go as a collective.
Because
wait staff all put it down a dish at exactly the same time on the table. And that was a punish. It was never right, never good enough. And, you know, I appreciate, it's funny, one of those things where you appreciate that further on down the line, because it's one of those things that you have that standard that you push onto other people as well. Not in a pretentious way or forcefully. We've come a long way, which is great, but it's one of those things where you just sort of sit there and you have a standard that you're like, well, no, if it's not good enough, it's not to be served. So how are we going to come up with a better solution? Should it even be on the plate? Instead of just making sure it's on the plate and it's done. Where I think now we look for different methods of doing stuff, or why are we doing it this way, or can it be, you know, turned into something else? But back in the day, it was like, it's just a yes chef and no chef. And sorry chef. Time and time and time again.
So fucked.
And every now and again, you try to do the best you can. And he'd be upstairs ordering and this, that, and everything else, and walk back downstairs and literally go through every single person's section And it'd be like, ah, yep, yep, that's all good. No, you need to do this again, this again, this again. You'd just be full service. It's like, oh, I don't know if I can have time for that. And just try to play catch up again.
That's so sick. It breeds good chess.
It does. I don't know what's going to happen in the future, actually, with what's coming through. Like, we seem to have lost... It's not the forcefulness, but...
The discipline
side of it, I think, is hard. You know, we've got so many front of house, back of house, doesn't matter who you are. You just, these days, especially after COVID, it's like, oh, I'm not feeling well, I'm not coming in today. And because everyone's so short-staffed, it's like, okay, no worries. Well, hopefully you can make it in tomorrow. I think I did that 3 times I remember I quit my job because I wasn't allowed to go to a friend's wedding or something, I think it was, because it wasn't allocated in my holiday time. Or, you know, for one reason or another, it was just like, no, you don't do that as a first year apprentice. It was like, sorry, you don't get those off. Like, you signed up as a chef. You don't, why would you think that you can have weekends off? It's a Saturday. Yeah. Sorry. And, you know, these days you got people like, oh, I need every second weekend off. And it's like, we only work weekends. Why do you think you can ask this?
And why do you apply for this job?
And why are you applying for hospitality? Because you don't like to work after 9 o'clock at night because you've got to get home early and you've got to do this, this, and this. I'm like, maybe you should consider another job role somewhere else, doing something else. But, you know, it's hard. Like, it's really hard on the industry at the moment, trying to collect a good team, hold on to that team, and grow together as well.
Yeah. No, it's fucking hard. And I'm always curious to see how chefs will go in the future, just because, like, even in my time, and I've noticed the change of chefs that I've grown up with to the new chefs coming in now that... have this like big ego, no experience, want more for less. Whereas we were just the ones that were like, we didn't expect anything, if not anything at all, just like a good job at a place we like.
Yeah.
And we'd work our asses off.
Yeah.
And it was like up here, you know, and it was just like, now it's just the complete opposite. And I'm like, I get there's a balance. I get some things that we probably did or went through were like, it was kind of shit, but you just did it. You just said you're a chef. And like, you wished you could have worked up the courage to ask for a day off you know what I mean? Like those little things. But at the same time, it's almost like going too far.
Agreed.
Like there's a right and the left, and like, we're like, you know, we're on the right. And then in a very short amount of time, probably the 2 years of COVID, I think.
Yeah, 2 or 3 years.
And it
just
went fucking wolf.
Yeah.
And now all the chefs coming in the industry, like consuming this chef media.
Yeah.
Being like, yeah, no, I've been on this section for like 2 weeks, I'm the best. Like, and I'm just like, fucking chill out, man. Like, I still haven't even gone to TAFE yet.
Yeah,
like,
I still remember I was a second year apprentice, nearly going to a third year, and was finishing TAFE and that sort of process. So I wrapped it up really quick because I got offered a job over in Europe, and I was like, okay, I'll go across for that. And they're like, oh, you need to finish your TAFE before you go. And I, you know, back as a second year, you're like, oh, I know what's going on. This is good. I've got this down pat. Yeah, like, I'm good. Yeah. And they're like, you're going to qualify. I'm like, oh my God, what do you mean? Like, I have to know every section in the kitchen. Like, I don't know if I'm ready to qualify. Let's not call me a qualified chef. I'm just comfortable with...
Yeah.
I know how to cook a little bit in every section, but I'm not ready to run anything or jump in the deep end or say I'm a grill chef or working in those bits and pieces. And it's hard. Like, these days, you know, we put ads up as for chefs and things. And just the applicants you get, you're sort of sitting there going, like, hats off to you for doing that. I remember back at Studio Neon, I was after, like, a head chef, so I could sort of take on more of the manager role. And my wife ended up taking that, and I stayed on as chef because we put an ad out. We were asking, like, good money back at the stage because we were overseeing 3 or 4 different venues and bits and pieces, and everything we did was unique. And creative and playful, so you sort of had to have the skill base. And most of the chefs that we had apply were like, oh, I've done, you know, my 2 years at Cordon Bleu and I've worked in a pub for 3 months. I'm like, mate, it's a $150,000 job. Like, what are you thinking? Like, hats off to you for thinking that you're at a standard, but it's also that level of justification that, you know, what makes you think you're good enough for that job right now at that pay level? Because from where I've come from as a chef, like, most of the times I think I took jobs and I never even asked about the pay.
You just
started getting paid and you're like, oh, that's nice. Or, you know, you'd go and stage for a month, sometimes 2 months, 3 months. I'm pretty sure with Thomas Keller, he was asking a minimum 3 months.
Oh, really?
To do a stage with him because he didn't want to take somebody in and then just filter them out straight away. And people would go and do it constantly.
Yeah.
You you sit there, and that's, you know, even taking a week off to go and stage and learn new things, I think would be fantastic. But no one would even think about doing it anymore. No. Like, we look at doing pop-ups and that fun bits and pieces. Like, I go and do that stuff for free.
Yeah.
I still get in trouble. My wife's always like, oh, why are you doing that? Like, you know, you get paid for this, this, and this. Oh, yeah, but it's fun.
Yeah.
Let's enjoy it.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, but I'm like, and then you start thinking about, like, oh, it is this and it is that. And then the kitchen hand you've got coming along to help you out, it's asking for $35 an hour. And you're like, hang on, I'm doing this for free. Why am I paying you $35 an hour? Like, this is costing me money now. Hang on. I've got to rethink this.
Yeah, it's crazy, man. Like, it's so crazy because it's just like, I feel bad for all the chefs that, like, have money as the incentive for, like, something that they should just love doing.
Yeah.
You know? And that's the difference when you talk about filtering through chefs. It's like, how much do they really care about their job?
Yeah.
And it's obviously, it's one not to get taken advantage of as well, but, like, absolutely, you do have to love it. Like, you just have to love it. Like, you can't, if you let their money get the better of you, the thought about it, it just starts to be distasteful and you resent it. And it's so sad because that's where a lot of chefs are, but it's just insane. Like, like, even Ben Sears is now, he's in Melbourne now, but was telling me about working at an Airbnb with, like, Annalise Gregory and Marco Pierre, and it's like the money that the people were just, like, lashing out on that. And it's like, fuck, like, it's out of my depth, man. Like, crazy.
It's so true. It's so true.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's a wild, wild world, but yeah.
And you can see why. I mean, look, if you can ask for that and get it as well, why wouldn't you?
But it's
also trying to come up with that balance, and
and
the hardest part is like, I find putting that into contract as a process of, like, if we've got you on board, what are you actually going to be doing?
Because
we used to do gourmet escapes and things like that over in WA and help out with different events, and half the time you'd have these guys fly in and fly out. Here's a menu. I'm like, this isn't a menu, this is a list of ingredients. Like, what do you want us to do? Oh, there's the photo. I'm like, I'm not cooking your signature dish based off a photo and no thing. Or you're reading it and you're going, that's not going to work.
Yeah.
I don't know where you came up with that idea that this is going to create that, because it's not. And I just know it from a chef's perspective, how I cook and what happens.
Yeah.
That doesn't equal that. Yeah. So you've had your PA or your EA multiply this recipe by 10 or 100 to get the result. And I'm like, you do not need 7 cups of sugar or 7 cups of salt to this recipe. It's not going to work.
So you
end up having to adjust everything that you were doing and produce something to the best ability based on what you're given. And they're all stoked, because I think they lose a lot of the care factor and the passion because they're paid to be that personality for the day,
not
to be in the kitchen. And
and
I always struggled, like, one of those things I'd love, there's so many really talented chefs out there doing pop-ups and that sort of stuff where they know their craft, they've studied it, they're looking for it, they want that next thing, but they don't have that celebrity chef persona about them to do stuff. Like, I always wanted, when in Studio Neon was first open in Redfern and we found out that Noma was coming, I've been lucky enough to eat at Noma a few times, and there's one of those things that I always say, there's some of the most incredible dishes I've ever had in my life.
Yeah.
Out of like 18, 20 courses, there's like 10 of them are in, like, just mind blowing. There's always like 5 that are like, oh yeah, that's nice, and there's always like 4 or 5 that I'm like, what were you thinking? How did that end up on a plate? Don't get it. I can't wrap my head around it. But you know, good for pushing it. But then you have couples sitting next to you at the same table or the bar, just like, oh, this is incredible, this is beautiful. And I'm like, do you really think that? Or is it just that you're sitting in world's best restaurant at the moment eating it, and it is that persona that it has to be the most delicious thing you've ever had? And I've had a lot of meats that are completely overcooked in Michelin star restaurants where people around you thoroughly enjoy it, or that's the new aspect that they've put into their mind, that's how it's meant to be. And it's like, no, that's not right. It's this instead. And it's interesting way of looking at it. But it's funny how that they can take on that persona. And I always thought when Noma first came out, I'm like, I'd love for them to come in and cook like a pop-up and then have everyone critique it without knowing it was the celebrity chef behind it.
I love that too.
Closed door.
Yeah.
And for them to come in and be like, right, this is it, and then think it was somebody else.
Yeah.
Find out what got said about it, and then be like, oh, and by the way, here's such and such. And they're like, sorry, what? Like,
yeah.
That side of things, I've always been so curious as to run a pop-up or an event like that, just to see whether the food style, quality, and all that stuff shines through on every aspect, or it's one of those things where you have to be in the moment of the time to be enjoying it, understand it, and then to put yourself outside that box a little bit to understand that person is at this level
and you're willing
to try things a little bit more different than usual.
It's pretty interesting, eh? Yeah, I think that would just be a fun thing to try. Just like, you just book tickets to an event and you don't know who it's going to be cooking.
Yeah.
They're behind closed curtains, and you go there, you eat, and then at the end you find out who the chef is, and it just could be anybody.
Yeah.
Like, I think that'd be kind of cool. That'd be an interesting concept, you know? So it's like, it's not about...
But then what celebrity chef would put the name forward for it? We can put it out there.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it doesn't have to be a celebrity chef. It could be a sous chef. Yeah, it could just be a sous chef at a restaurant who just wants to like try their own thing.
Yeah.
And there's no... You don't know who it is. It's just like, but like, you have people that are supporting it, people with a big name going, yeah, like, do it. Like, this is a good way to get chefs out there.
Yeah.
It could be anybody, you know? Yeah. It's like the black box of chefs. You open up and go, oh, fuck.
Yeah. Well, that's sort of what our Sunday sous chef was.
Oh, yeah. True.
It was like taking a sous chef from a hatted restaurant and putting him in a kitchen with no boundaries.
And that's sick.
And that worked really well for what it was.
Just, how many of those did you do?
We did four. We only did the 1 year. Yeah. And then it was so expensive the first year. I was like, oh, I don't know if I can do this next year as a marketing ploy. And we were lucky that the second year we couldn't find restaurants and things like that to be able to do it.
Right.
And we were building our own space in Alexandria. And then after that, unfortunately, COVID hit and we just sort of closed up. So it's still something that's on the back of my mind. I still love that process of things. But we're also really lucky with so many people doing pop-ups now. It's just like chefs are opening up their restaurants for the younger generation to come in and play.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate that. We don't need to go and set up huge marketing campaigns and book restaurants or take over restaurants and fully fit them out and go through that whole process like we did.
Do it.
You've got chefs where they're just like opening up a space and going, yeah, sure, here's four up and coming people in the local area, this is what they're going to do.
Oh, like Pippet.
And Pippet, prime example.
So good.
And that's sold out in minutes. I wanted to try to get tickets to that. I left it for literally half an hour and asked my wife whether she was available and it was gone. I'm like, I shouldn't have even thought about it.
But, yeah.
You know.
It's good, but that's sick. That's why it's really sick what he's doing there, you know? Yeah. Like, he's just doing his thing. There's no expectations. It's just like, having fun with it all. It's so sick.
And it's also amazing what you can learn as a chef from these up and comers, because half of them are looking at stuff with clear eyes or with no idea at all and just being like, how about if I do this?
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't have thought about that. That's a great idea.
Hang on,
let me tweak this and do this, and that's bang on.
Yeah.
It's sick. Yeah, it's a really good way of doing it.
Yeah, I think it's mad. Like, and I don't know, like, because I was reading about these Sunday sous chef sessions.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing names like Khan Nguyen and Big Sam Young.
Yeah.
How did this work? Was this, would it just be one of those chefs at a time?
Yes.
Or would it be a...
Yeah, so we ran it over 4 weeks. We took over the old Mark space in Surrey Hills.
Oh, really?
And so, crazy. Once Mark finished with that, we went and took that on, fully fitted it out again. Half the equipment was there, half of it wasn't.
Yeah.
And then we hit up the guys and so Khan was one of them, Sam was one. Alex was from North Bondi Fish.
Mm-hmm.
And who else do we have?
But so
it's more important. But they've all gone on to do amazing things. It's ridiculous.
But just one of those would come in on Sunday.
Yeah, we'd open it up and say, here you go, this is what it is. We got sponsors on board, we had Johto Fish and Vic's Meats and things like that, and said, this is your budget for produce each week. It's based on 50 people. Here's some staff. We've fully staffed the front of house and then helped out with kitchen hands and things in the back. If they wanted to bring staff along to help them as well, they could. And they took over the kitchen for the night and produced all the food for it, served it, and again, no boundaries. It was canapes and three courses, or four courses, I think it was. And they could do whatever they wanted.
I was actually curious to ask, like, because obviously you did dive into a bit of the private chefing for celebrities and shit, but Would you recommend that for chefs? Like, not as like a career path, not as in a, yeah. If you're a chef, you should probably go work in Europe because it's good experience. Like, I don't mean like go, but like having done that now, it being a completely different experience of what it's like to be a chef in a restaurant. And from your experience, like, would you recommend that? And like, how was that like for you? Like,
look, I thoroughly enjoyed it while I was there and doing it. I was very lucky. Most of the clients I had, I also researched them as much as they researched me. Sort of
really?
Thing. So you spend a lot of time going back. Even now, I would still, if anyone wants to come up to me, I'm like, oh yeah, great. I'd love to speak to your past chef to understand, you know, what you're saying is actually correct. And when it comes to dinner parties and that sort of stuff.
Really?
Like, half the time it's like, oh, it's a family of four. We don't go out much. We don't do this. We don't do that.
Yeah.
We never have dinner parties. And then you're doing a dinner party every week for 20 people by yourself. And it's a punish in a home kitchen.
Yeah.
So it's all that sort of thing. You've got some people where, you know, some of the horror stories I've heard are just
working
with celebrities and chefs and that work on yachts and things like that. I was lucky. So lucky. Oh, look, just think that I have a mate of mine that worked on the yachts, and the owner's wife would wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning and want fresh croissants. And just because it was just a thing that she wanted, just to know that he would get up and make that product for her. She'd ask for a different flavor, croissant or, you know, pastry or something. He'd spend his hours in the kitchen putting it down there, and she wouldn't even be awake for it. She just wanted it sitting by the doorstep, knowing that he'd created that for her. Just that control side of things. We've had horror stories.
Because that's what I'm curious about. Because I'm like, however cool it might be, because that seems to be what the media likes to latch onto, right? It's a selling point, which is cool for people who aren't chefs.
Oh, absolutely. Look,
but
you know,
for chefs that actually want to do it, like, is that worth it? Because it's like, you could work in toxic kitchens that are all around the world, but like working for celebrities can sometimes be.
You also
just
can
as
be
bad.
Working for toxic people.
Yeah.
So it's a tough one. Like, yeah, I was lucky with the people I worked for. Are always really giving, open, sort of stuff. It's a crazy world.
Yeah.
Like, I had no idea.
I had no idea.
Into it, and then you go further and further down. The more you get into it, it's everyone's friends with everyone. So it was one of those things that every time you left a job, you got a pay increase because you were usually working for someone that had been at the table, and they love to talk about how much you cost per week, which is usually two or three times what you were ever getting paid. So such and such would then, like, when you decided to leave, they'd be like, oh, look, we understand you're on this, so we'll give you this extra. And you're like, okay, I've just doubled my wage again. Great. Thanks very much, guys.
Wow.
So it comes along. It can work in your favor that way.
Fuck.
But you know, you can get caught up in it really easy as well, which is kind of where I got out of it, because you had the cars, you had the houses, you had everything.
Oh, really?
Like, if you get close enough to those people, you're allowed to use whatever you want, whenever you want. You're picking up kids from places. You know, I'd never park in a car park. I'd park on the street and get a fine because it was usually cheaper than paying for a car parking space. And I'd open up the glove box at the end of the month and collect all the fines and just be like, there you go. That's my weekly or my monthly shopping parking fines and stuff like that. Because, you know, over in Spain and places, the parking, you know, you just park wherever and they're like, oh, it's fine. Don't worry about it. Like, it's a full-time job managing their money.
Wow.
As from a chef perspective of what I got out of it, I'd have to say I probably learned more working as a private chef than I did working in Haddad and Michelin star restaurants, in a way that I had so much time on my hands. You'd have to be the first one up at like 5 o'clock in the morning. Ready for them, just in case they decided to walk downstairs for breakfast, knowing full well they weren't going to come down till 9, 10 o'clock.
Right.
But you had to be ready, table set, ready to go, just in case. So that was time reading books, watching podcasts, this, that, you know, TV, the whole lot, and understanding food. And then most of the time I had an unlimited budget. So if I wanted to play around with lobster, I could go and buy 10 lobsters.
That's sick.
And if I ruined it every single time, I'd just go and buy 10 more.
Yeah.
And I'd play and play and play. You know, we wanted equipment. You could get equipment. If I could walk out and tell them, oh, I'm just going to go and buy a Paco jet. They're like, yeah, no worries, cool. And you'd have a Paco jet in the kitchen. Like, it got...
That's sick.
Money was no object. And it was bizarre. I was talking to someone a while ago about having to pick up the kids from golf, they just rang and I was out and about and I was in a sports car. And it was one of those things like, oh, look, you know, Harry wants to bring his friend home for the evening as well for a sleepover. They both had golf clubs, and talking about a seven-year-old child,
right,
times two. And I was like, oh, I don't know what to do. This is a bit strange. And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, no worries. And I looked up and there's a Range Rover dealership. And I was like, oh, okay. And we went and bought a Range Rover and said, you know, we'll pay this if we do this. Put on the car.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Walk back over. I said, I've got the kids home. Yeah, that's fine. No worries. Security went and picked up my car and drove it back. And I was like, well, you know, for me, it was like, this is much better for shopping. Like, it's a lot easier for us to have this and work along these lines instead. And they're like, yeah, no worries. That's fine. The person I was talking to was like, don't they have taxis in Spain? I never thought about it. I could have just caught a cab. But
yeah,
mind... And process just stopped thinking like that.
Yeah,
Oh, you can buy a car and take it home and
that's crazy.
They're not going to worry about it.
Yeah.
Because as long as you can justify why you're doing it, what you're doing, it wasn't a process.
Wow.
So, you know, when it comes to the cooking side of things, yes, it was challenging, but at the same time, I learned so much.
Yeah.
Because you had unlimited budgets. You could go and get the fresh produce every single day. They needed it and required it. And then more often than not, if there was something they liked or they had an incredible meal out, you'd get flown there, or they'd say, yeah, go and enjoy this and do that. Like El Bulli, I think I ate there three times where they were like, oh, we love this vichyssoise. Well, can you go and test it out? And I'm like, you're going to fly me to El Bulli to eat because you want a soup? They're like, yeah, it's amazing. I'm like, okay, no worries. And it's
so
that process.
So you can kind of recreate it or something?
Yeah, just so you can recreate it for them at home.
Fuck.
And it's like, yeah, I can try. Like, it is at the moment world's best restaurant, but... can definitely try.
Yeah, I could totally try.
You know, and that process. So if there were things they liked in the area, or it didn't matter where it was, they would then, you know, you could go and try and enjoy it and see what you thought. So it did come with the perks. You know, it also comes with the downsides where we were living in Spain and would have to fly in milk and Scottish salmon from the UK in private jets and that sort of stuff, which everyone's like, oh my God, that's amazing. No, it's not the challenge. And then the concept of, as time goes on and on and on, the money side of things gets to you and you're sort of like, why are we chartering, you know, why are you sending a private jet across with Tetley tea bags and $200 worth of stuff? Then I can get this milk down the road. But for them, that's all they know. And that's the process they want to run along.
It's crazy, yeah.
And that's okay for them.
Yeah.
You know, I had friends on yachts that were flying, they'd have helicopters fly out and drop off packets of tacos and watermelons and punnets of strawberries and things like that. So it's hard to get a grip and a grasp on reality when you're in that, because it's just, if you want it, you get it.
Yeah.
And that's their concept and that's the way they work. And
that's why I was saying when we're walking around, I'm like, I feel so out of place here because it's not a world I'm used to. This luxe. It's beautiful, very beautiful. Don't get me wrong, you can totally appreciate it, but like, it doesn't feel like I'm supposed to be here because it's not where I'm from. Like, I was born down in like Wollongong, south Wollongong. It's not like, it's not a very rich place. Like, I mean, it can be. It can be.
Well, it's getting up there now.
But
half like Sydney's moving there.
Yeah. So I guess I'm not really. I'm from like south of Wollongong.
Yeah.
But it was like department housing. So like, it's fucking like. No, it's like nothing. The government doesn't give a fuck. Like, you know, like they're just tin sheds. But walking around it, it's like, man, this is like not a world I'm used to. So I can imagine yourself just like experiencing that for the first time. It's like, is this really like,
I think the hardest thing is that you went through that process and you started off smaller and then got larger and larger and larger. And to the point where some of the people you're working for, they just had no concept of money at all whatsoever. And it was just a process that you then needed to wean yourself out of it as well.
As
part of that process that you get to it and you're like, this isn't reality for anybody else. I can't continue to keep doing this. Otherwise, you have to do it for the rest of your life. You've got to pull the pin at a certain point. So, you know, I'm all for people going and doing a ski season in Aspen or something like that. And that, again, comes with so many different challenges that you don't think about, or even private jets and helicopters of anything that you put, food products that you're putting there, sponges are growing, doing sponge cake at a different altitude and it just doesn't work. And it's that working those concepts out that you don't even think about because you don't have to.
Yeah.
And part of being a chef is you never stop learning.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how many times you've done something, you're still going to get it wrong every now and again and try to work and break that back and try to understand why it's not working. And, you know, it's the same with going out and foraging. You think everything should be perfect, should all be just there, and it's not.
Mm.
And it's that why.
Yeah.
Trying to understand it, which is what I think is so important. And it's you never stop learning.
Yeah.
You just have to keep questioning yourself.
Keep
questioning the process.
Yeah.
And just continue on.
You're a big fan of cars, I hear. You're interested in the world of cars, is this right?
Yeah, oh, look, a mixture of both, yeah.
Okay.
Used to be.
Yeah, right.
You had garages full of them that you didn't own and you still got to drive them.
Yeah. I heard that you once got pulled over by the cops, but the cops are so in love with your car that they took it for a joyride themselves.
They did, yeah. It was back in the day.
Tell us about this story.
That was over in Spain. We had... Porsche Carrera GT.
You had a great time in Spain, it sounds like.
Look, when you had employers like I did, unlimited toys, and they were away most of the time, so you just got to play with toys. It got pulled over, and I don't even know what I got pulled over for. I think the main reason is they just liked the car that my employer had, and I had, usually you'd have wads of cash in the car, to be able to pay them off for anything you did wrong.
Oh, really? Is that just standard?
Yeah, standard.
Yeah, right.
Or used to be standard. And yeah, they were like, oh, you know, what? Oh, we might have, like, they were going along the lines of me being arrested. And I was sitting there going, oh, I don't know what to do. I can't offer them anything. My employer's not even in the country at the moment. How is this going to unfold? And one of the guys was like, oh, if you let me take your car for a ride, for a drive, like, we'll let you go. So I sat there, I'm like, this is a bit dodgy. Like, these are two police officers. I don't know if this is going to work and how this is going to work, but it's going to get me out of trouble and my employer's not going to find out about it. We just can't crash the car. And I thought, worst case scenario, what could go wrong? And yeah, they came in, took it for a spin up and down the hill, which was Ronda, which is a known hill for motorcycle racing and things like that. They had a great time for about 15 minutes. I said, thanks very much. Have a nice day. And I was like, oh, wow, that worked. Interesting. Cool. Thanks very much. I drove away. And it's one of those things that never had to worry about anything again.
Wow. That's insane. Sounds like a life.
I wish it was my car, but it wasn't. Yeah. I just got to use them.
Yeah. That's crazy. This is just like shit that you look back on and just go, can't believe that was a life.
So many things. Like, I've got friends, a friend of mine, really close friend, she worked as a nanny in the similar world and similar people and that sort of stuff. And we sometimes sit down and talk shit. And it was like, if people could hear our conversation right now as to what was happening, like, no one would understand what we're talking about.
The
possibilities of these, of what is these people are capable of doing or asking or that process. It's not a thing. It's for them to buy things, waste money, break stuff, get new stuff. You know, it's unbelievable.
And
it's just one of those things you just can't fathom it until you're in that world or you've seen some of that world. You just can't.
I think it's like we were talking about before, it just becomes like a mindset. Wealth stops becoming a material at some point and just becomes a mindset. Like you said, they don't have a concept of money anymore.
No.
You know, and it's just like, yeah, I can't even think. It's like trying to think about quantum physics. It's like, I don't even have the head for it because it's not something I've ever lived in. But
well, it's like some of the football players that we used to do dinner parties for and stuff like that. We worked out that they earned enough in a week to buy a brand new Ferrari every single week.
Yeah.
And that's not a lot.
Yeah.
For them.
For them.
And you sort of sit there and go, what would I spend that on every single
week? You're struggling to come up with kitchen equipment to go, I'll get hibachi maybe. How much money do I have left?
How do you spend $300,000 a week and what do you spend it on? I don't know. I just don't know.
That's crazy.
We're trying to produce food now.
I don't even know if there's an ingredient that would cost that much, but that's crazy, man. I don't know. I guess it's kind of that nice circle of where you are now, where you've kind of, as everyone does, you've kind of lived that life, and it's just just having a bit of peace now. So I can sense that when I walk here.
Absolutely. Like, and that's the best part. Like, you know, we've got a beautiful wife, got an incredible 1 year old now, just turned one the other day. We've got our property growing, you know, fruit and vegetables and stuff like that, mowing lawns. And it's just that change, doing small renovations on the house, but it's just that ongoing, it's normality.
Mm.
And it's that process. You come to work, we're lucky to have this incredible space here that's just, you know, it's unbelievable. It's like Truman Show. We've got so many gardeners here that a leaf falls on the ground and gets picked up within a couple of minutes. And that process of just everything's immaculate.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really nice.
That's crazy.
It's a good balance. I wouldn't want to go back to where I was either, given that. Like,
Do they ever often text you to ask if you'd be interested? Or?
And you're like, sorry, not guys. Not so much. Like, a lot of the agents would. They still hit me up every now and again. Like, oh, I've got this job over in here. And I'm like, well, you know, family, children, fly to such and such for 6 months. We had someone wanting us to go to Barbados recently for 10 days and a ridiculous amount of money. It's like, nah, thanks.
Yeah.
You know, you're in a full-time job role as well. You can't just drop anything. And it's bizarre how your mind used to think. You'd be like, sure, no worries, give me 2 days.
Yeah.
And I'd need 48 hours from anything to organize and change anything to then be on a plane going somewhere.
Yeah.
And I came back and bought cars and bought everything that made me settle.
Because
I didn't want that excuse to be able to just like, see ya.
And
disappear without thought.
Yeah.
I've definitely preferred the grounded life and that process.
Yeah. I guess we just leaves us with this last question, which is I guess it kind of sums up. I guess you probably have different stories, but it sums up just like someone's career in a retrospective manner, but from a purely humbleness and a humility. And the question is the funniest or craziest time you found yourself most in the shit. You could probably rattle off stories for days, and please, if you have two or three, go for it. But while you think about it, I'll share you the story from my previous guest, who gave his most in the shit moment, and that's Jason Saxby at Raise.
Yeah, nice.
And he gave me two, and it's pretty funny. This is the first one was when he was at Pillars at Freshwater.
Yeah.
And they do quite a lot of functions there, and they were probably doing, you know, it's quite a lot. Like, it would have a high turnover of weddings and functions. So, like, you know, they would be doing one function at the lunchtime, and then everything would have to get turned over in different glassware or plates, whatever, for who was paying for whatever range at nighttime. So, like, it was quite crazy, and it'd be a completely different menu. So you can imagine how, you know, non-stop it is. I'm sure you know. So it got to the night time and they were working with like a Fremantle octopus.
Yeah.
They had 70 people. Jason Saxby turns to his very, very competent sous chef at the time. It's like, just double check the portion count, you know? The guy's like, oh, you know, there's 77. And Jason's like, just double count it for me. Like, just double count. Like, whatever you do, double count something.
Yeah.
You'll always make a mistake. And
measure
twice.
Yeah. Once.
And so the suit's like, yeah, cool, all good. I got 77. The 70 people, we'll be fine. And they're like, sick. So they get the wedding going. It was like a 7-course degustation. It was like the 3rd course. And so they get it going, they're setting all their tables, and they get to the last one, and Jason's like, yep, sick. The sous chef's like, oh, awesome, cool. That was it. Like, let's get ready on the next course or whatever. And Jason's like, no, we still got one more table for this course, for the octopus course.
Yeah.
And the suit's like, oh, are you serious? I thought he'd be joking around.
Yeah.
And the suit's like, I don't have any portions left. Like, we've got like another table of like 11 and he only had like 4 portions.
Yeah.
And Jason's sitting there thinking like, fuck. Like, and they'd used all their scraps and offcuts to make like an octopus salad and a staff meal and all this sort of shit. Yeah. So you're a part of you sitting there thinking like, if I just didn't use the offcuts for staff meal, I could probably make something happen. But
how much of staff meals is there? Is it still eaten?
You're like, am I gonna stoop that low?
Yeah.
Can I? And he was like, nah. So they had to think of something else, like for the last table. And he was just like, fuck. Like, and mind you, like, he just darted into the cool room thinking, of course they do functions. Like, they'll have something, but it needs to be something close. It can't just be like a beef, you know, like it's got to be something seafood. And he's like, fuck, what can we do? And I managed to pull out these like mussels from the freezer, which they were doing a similar dish with mussels, just with a different garnish. And they had to pull that out and like fucking do it because like the table's expecting their food now. So you have to pull out a dish in like 10, 15 tops. And they just had to do the same dish with mussels. And it was just like, Jason was telling me, he's like, he turned to his apprentice and like not a word was spoken.
Yeah.
It's like, they knew how fucking shit the situation was. And it was like, I think my sous chef went home and just beat himself up about it.
Yeah.
So I didn't have to.
Yeah.
Because you can tell when he's so upset at himself.
Yeah.
And he was like, we put the food on the pass. We just said something to the front of house and just, they just told him like, don't question it. It just is what it is. Take it out and that's it. And he was like, not a word was spoken about it. It was just like, so shit.
Yeah.
But I don't know. What about for yourself? Do you have any stories that come to mind?
Yeah, like too many. Really, it's too many. Look, we had Studio Neon for 12 years, which was mainly off-site catering.
Yeah.
We were working for you know, we're doing events for Ferrari where we're putting ply boards down in their mechanics shed, which is probably cleaner than your bedroom, and serving off that. But no open flame. None of this, none of that. You're working in places for Louis Vuitton and Gucci where you can't have any steam, you can't have any smoke, you can't have any flavor.
That's crazy.
Or you've got clothing and designer handbags all around you when you're cooking in their stores. So sous vide came in really handy, but then it was like, oh, there's a little bit of steam, can you not? Or they've put you in a space where you've got fire alarms above you and all sorts. So doing site recce became a very popular thing. Walking into people's homes that have multi-million dollar kitchens and the ovens don't work,
really,
or they've just not plugged in or turned on or things like that. So you know, over the years we've done open fire cooking where they turn around and you've planned events for 3 months and could be up for 500 to 1,000 people all cooked on open fire, and you get a fire ban on the day. And at 12 o'clock when your meals are half cooked, they turn around and there's a fire ban. You've got to put all your fires out. And you haven't got other bits and pieces of working. Like, how do you do this? What do you do?
Where was this place?
That was on Cockatoo Island.
Oh, really? In the Sydney City?
Yeah.
I know bartenders that have worked there.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Depends on what happens. We did an event with Jared Ingersoll. And that was pretty balls deep where they decided we were in the Mint. And so that's all heritage listed building, and part of that process we're cooking beasts on the spit on open fire, and the smoke started going in and getting caught up in the air conditioning units or something there, so they made us move this fire pit that was probably 15 meters by 5 meters to the other end of the block halfway through cooking it with a time frame and just rebuild it and relight it. It was like moving all the animals across and restarting there, and then the wind changed, and because we were closer to the road, the smoke was then going into the park and over that, so we had fire engines all turn up and
really
shut that down, and we were like lucky enough to talk our way out of it to be able to produce something. But because you'd relit fires, everything was burnt on the outside, raw on the inside, and trying to work out what to do, and so you're cutting meats off and splaying it open instead of having the slow cooked process. And yeah, there's so many.
Where was that? So
that was in the Mint.
Mint.
Yeah, right in the centre of Sydney there.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Fuck. That's insane.
So there's so many that I could think of where we've just turned up, or you know, somebody's wanted to. I think my whole process of running Studio Neon was I wouldn't sleep for maybe 1 or 2 days prior to large scale events because it was my job and role to think of anything that could go wrong.
And try
to replicate it in my head as to what changes I would make.
Right.
So that didn't happen. So if you turned up there and they put you straight underneath a fire alarm or a jet, that you'd be like, oh, well, we can't have it there. Let's move it to the other side here and let's just swap this from one side to the other and let's do this instead. Where, you know, all of these circumstances just got thrown out that you'd have to think about. It was all about, you know, problem solving. It wasn't so much about the cooking side of things. It's all about problem solving. Or, you know, weddings and things where you've got all this length of time and all of a sudden they're like, oh, no, we want it an hour forward because we want to get photos of this, this, and this. And it's like, well, you just can't do that. We're not ready.
That's not how it works.
We come from this philosophy of saying yes.
Yeah.
I'm going to do the best I possibly can. It's like, all right, guys, shit's going down. We just got to make it happen.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's a crazy world. Hospitality, like, it's a love-hate relationship.
Yeah,
I'll tell you what, it's one of those things that I think we all struggle with it, but you don't know what else you would do.
Yeah.
At the same time.
Yeah.
And the stories are just coming. Keep coming.
It's like, so good.
It's a worry when you start to think about it.
Yeah.
It's crazy days.
I think that'll sum up the podcast.
That's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, I appreciate that, man. I'm gonna finish it there if you're cool with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Sounds good. Done. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for tuning into today's episode. If you'd like to listen to more episodes or check out some cool behind the scenes photography, then head to the new website over at rootshospitality.com.au or follow Roots Hospitality on Instagram for the latest updates. Cheers!